For the better part of a century, WBAI has been here for us. In times of war, in search of peace, from local community to global reach, stretching the imagination and enriching the mind. Listener-funded, commercial-free, and now soon comes the time to take responsibility. I'm Robert Knight, inviting you to be there for BAI in our 51st annual fund drive starting February 3rd, so all our voices can be heard in this new century when we'll need BAI even more than ever before to move from outrage to inspiration. So be here for BAI as a volunteer with a call to Vera at 212-209-2826. That's WBAI 99.5 Pacifica, radio for a change.
On Thursday evening, January 28th, Revolution Books presents an evening with two of the lawyers who have defended Guantanamo prisoners and brought the truth about Gitmo to the world. Meet attorney Mark Denbo, author of a new book, Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law, and Yvonne Bradley, the lawyer appointed in 2005 as military defense counsel for a British prisoner in the military commissions at Guantanamo. That's 7 p.m. Thursday, January 28th at Revolution Books, 146 West 26th Street. For more information, call 212-691-3345. That's 212-691-3345.
Swimming and feel like I'm drowning. Pushing and climbing and flying and feel like I'm falling. Can you see the light when life falls? Kuzung.
That's Kuzunguka from If the Rains Come First by the artist Somi, and she'll be appearing tonight at the Jazz Standard. Two sets at 7:30 and 9:30 p.m. Go on over there and check her out. You are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York. We're broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Coming up next at 6 p.m., the WBAI Evening News at 7 o'clock. Tahrir, Voices of the Middle East, here in the U.S. and abroad. And as we continue the business of taking WBAI forward, it is imperative that we remember that we are what our record says that we are, to borrow a phrase from Earl Caldwell, the first successfully planned and completed million-dollar fundraising and membership drive in the history of Pacifica Radio took place right here at WBAI. And as we approach this upcoming winter fundraising drive, we know we can count on you to take us farther than we've ever gone before, redoubling our commitment to the Pacifica mission, promoting peace and understanding between peoples of all nations. It's 6 p.m. in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org. Please stay tuned for a report of some of the day's events with the WBAI news team.
Good evening. In the news tonight, a new study finds people across the country are struggling to afford enough food, and the area with the greatest hardship is right here in New York City. A court has ruled that a Rent Guidelines Board decision led to thousands of tenants being overcharged for their rent, and a bill has been introduced in the Senate to allow the president to decide if a terrorism suspect gets a criminal trial or is turned over to intelligence agencies. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Tuesday, January 26th, 2010. A study released today shows that food hardship, lacking the financial resources to buy enough food to feed a family, is rampant nationwide. The study was conducted by Gallup on behalf of the Food Research and Action Center in Washington. Covering the past 2 years, it found that for the nation as a whole, food hardship rose from 16.3% of households in the first quarter of 2008 to 19.5% in the fourth quarter of that year. In 2009, the rate dropped slightly, falling to 18.5% by the end of the year. And for families with children, the rates were even higher. The survey covers every congressional district in the country, as well as the 100 largest metropolitan areas. Of the 436 congressional districts, including the District of Columbia, 311 had a food hardship rate of 15% or higher. In 139 of them, the rate was 20% or higher. Practically every congressional district in the country had more than 1 in 10 respondents reporting food hardship, and the district reporting the highest hunger rate of all was here in New York. Joel Berg, executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, says to collect the data, Gallup talked to about 1,000 people a day, more than 650,000 people across the country in all.
And it found, no shock, that a huge number of people in America said that in 2008 and 2009 they didn't have enough money to buy food. Nearly 1 in 5 Americans said they did not have enough money in the last year to buy all the food they need. It's still a country with nearly 400 billionaires, so it really is shocking still today that tens of millions of Americans don't have enough money for food.
Well, 53 of those billionaires live in New York City. How did New York City fare in this survey?
New York City did very poorly. In fact, more than half of the congressional districts in New York City, 7 of the 13 congressional districts in New York City, had severe food hardships, which I characterize as having more than 20% of residents in each of those districts not having enough money for food. In fact, the very hardest hit congressional district in the entire country is in New York City. It is in the South Bronx, the 16th congressional district represented by Congressman Serrano. He's been talking about these issues for a long time, and so he did send a letter to Mayor Bloomberg today and to Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack asking for them to take more action on this. But also Congressman Towns' district in central Brooklyn was the 6th hungriest district in the entire United States. This is out of more than 400 congressional districts, so it's a particularly severe problem in New York and particularly stunning given how much wealth there is in the city overall still.
Is this a problem that snuck up on us or that we just haven't been aware of? Certainly, I'm sure it's been made worse by the current economic crisis, but entitlements programs, food stamps, the city has been reluctant to promote food stamps for years. What's the root cause here?
Well, this is a problem that is certainly clear to the tens of millions of Americans suffering it. It's also a problem that's been clear to BAI listeners for quite a while, because this is one of the few stations in the country that's really given poverty and hunger consistent focus. But if all you were watching was the mainstream media, and if you even took a few minutes away from watching American Idol or the late-night slugfests to actually watch the news, you wouldn't even see this on the news. You'd still see shock that there were poor people in New Orleans after Katrina, and shock that there are poor people in Haiti after an earthquake. But too many Americans don't want to see the shock that Americans are going through an economic earthquake every day.
What needs to be done? Senator Gillibrand is calling for an extra $500 million in the Agriculture Committee for food programs. Is that enough with this many people nationwide facing food shortages? It seems like the investment would have to be huge.
Well, we certainly need a few billion dollars, but we know hunger in America costs our economy over $100 billion a year because hungry workers work less efficiently, hungry children learn less efficiently, hungry Americans of all ages and malnourished Americans of all ages cost the society tens of billions of dollars in health care spending. So we would argue that the few billion dollars necessary to really reverse the growing hunger, and particularly child hunger, in America is a very worthwhile investment, and the country more than has enough money, even with this big deficit, to deal with that.
Considering that New York City has such a high rate of hunger, should federal poverty programs be indexed to cost of living for specific areas? Because New York City is much more expensive, food is more expensive, everything is more expensive here, and yet the poverty rate in New York City for federal purposes is figured the same.
certainly the federal poverty rate should be indexed. It's because of historical and political reasons it's actually indexed in Hawaii and Alaska, but not New York City, where it's much more expensive. But it's a real problem nationwide, and these programs need to be expanded nationwide. And most importantly, we need a serious focus on creating living wage jobs. It's sort of a cliche that the best social program is a job. If people actually made that phrase, the best social program is a living wage job, then I would support that concept 1,000%, and I think the vast majority of low-income people would. They want jobs that have good working conditions, maybe challenging, but at least pay them enough to meet their bills and have a chance of moving into the middle class. And we need a top-down reorientation of all our policies to get there.
Well, now that this survey is done and these figures are out, do you think it's enough to catch the attention of politicians in Washington and to get some real action?
This report certainly got in people's attention. We have statements in our release today from Senator Schumer, Senator Gillibrand, Congressman Serrano, Congressman Towns, and the Speaker of the City Council, Christine Quinn. Now we all have to work together to get these policies necessary to turn this around in place.
Joel Berg is executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. A Manhattan court has ruled in favor of a grassroots housing organization against the City Rent Guidelines Board, saying it overcharged hundreds of thousands of tenants when it created a set fixed dollar increase on monthly rents below $1,000. Judge Emily Jane Goodman in Manhattan Supreme Court said the rent hike, quote, penalized tenants for failing to move in a city that has virtually no affordable housing, end quote. It was the most recent victory for tenants fighting landlords' zealousness to squeeze the most from their city land holdings. Tenants and neighbors were the lead plaintiffs in the case and are delighted at the victory. WBAI's Rebecca Miles spoke to Maggie Russell Ciardi, executive director of Tenants and Neighbors, who said her group had been watching the progression of the new rent since its inception.
In 2008 and 2009, the Rent Guidelines Board didn't just pass very high rent increases for all rent-stabilized tenants. They also passed a minimum increase for tenants who had been living in their apartments for 6 years or more and whose rent was under $1,000. Those tenants would pay higher increases than everyone else. And so Tenants and Neighbors was a plaintiff in a lawsuit that was filed by the Legal Aid Society and South Brooklyn Legal Services, arguing that the Rent Guidelines Board didn't have the authority to create two different rent increases, one for tenants who had lived in their apartment 6 years or more and one for tenants who hadn't. So we filed lawsuits both years, and the judge just issued the decision that they were, in fact, exceeding their authority when they created those two different types of housing accommodations and that they didn't have the authority to pass those higher increases for the long-term tenants.
So in handing down this decision on behalf of the plaintiff, what happens now?
My guess is there may be an appeal of the case, but I think the entire tenant movement feels very confident going forward that the decision will be ultimately overturned.
And what about getting their money back? Is that a likelihood?
We're hoping that tenants will be reimbursed for the difference between what they actually paid in increases and what they should have paid, and we're looking for the courts to sort that out.
So going forward, will landlords now have to put people's rents back to what they were before you had to go to court?
That's my understanding, but I think we're still waiting for all of this to be resolved by the courts.
It seems, and I could be wrong about this, but certainly there was tenant dissent at Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper over the things that were going on there when new management came in and started doing nefarious things with residents there by increasing rents. And it seems that tenants are fighting back. Is that your impression too?
That's right. I mean, tenants all over the city are fighting back against a wide range of tactics that are used by landlords to displace low and moderate income people from their homes. One is the Rent Guidelines Board sort of constantly passing very high rent increases that tenants can't afford. Tenants have been mobilizing to stop that. And they've also been mobilizing against these predatory equity investors like Tishman Speyer, who acquired Stuytown, and many other private equity-backed investors that have been buying up affordable housing and using every mechanism available to them to get rents to the threshold at which they can be decontrolled, which includes going to the Rent Guidelines Board to lobby for high rent increases, also tenant harassment to get tenants out because you have to actually have the apartment become vacant in order for it to be decontrolled. So tenants have been fighting back in both at Stuytown and then in, you know, developments across the city that have been acquired by these speculative investors who are trying to get out the long-term tenants and bring in higher income folks into market rate or luxury housing.
And do you work with each group individually, or are you finding that in some cases you can get a whole large group together to that the landlords coming up with creative ideas that are doing the same sort of damage to tenants, that you're finding that you can link, for instance, tenants in a East Harlem building complex with people at Stuyvesant, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. We're organizing a group of tenants at the Riverton houses that are fighting back against, their building was also over-leveraged by a private equity speculator and now is in foreclosure, much like Stuyvesant Town. And the same special servicer is overseeing both of the foreclosure proceedings. So that's a real natural alliance between those folks on the east side of Manhattan and up in Harlem. And we're trying to facilitate these kinds of alliances where tenants who are in very similar circumstances, either they have the same investor or the same landlord or they're dealing with the same kinds of challenges, can come together and strategize about how to solve those problems and, you know, really build very unique alliances that have the power to bring about change that tenants working by themselves don't necessarily have the power to do.
And what else are you working on at the moment? What other things are on the horizon?
Well, so you mentioned Stuytown, and that was one of the buildings where the owner had been improperly deregulating apartments while receiving J51 tax abatements from the city. So one thing we're doing now is trying to identify other buildings that may also have been improperly deregulated and educating the tenants in those buildings about the fact that, in fact, they might actually be entitled to have a rent-regulated apartment and they might be being overcharged for their rent. So doing education and organizing in those buildings to try to get them re-regulated. In terms of the RGB, Marvin Marcus, who's been the chair of the RGB under the Bloomberg administration, has recently announced his resignation. He'll be leaving at the end of February. And that provides a really unique opportunity for the Bloomberg administration to appoint someone for that position who really is committed to the continued existence of rent regulation and who understands what are the issues faced by low and moderate income tenants in New York. So tenants and neighbors will be mobilizing to try to influence that decision and make sure that whoever is in that position takes it very, very seriously and is accountable to tenants. So those are two sort of key campaigns that we're going to be focusing on in the coming months.
Maggie Russell Ciardi is the Executive Director of Tenants and Neighbors. She spoke with WBAI's Rebecca Miles. Fueled by fears of new regulations, the stock market slid lower again today. Those fears were magnified last week when President Obama proposed legislation to limit the size of large financial institutions. Many of the largest banks and other financial institutions have been announcing huge profits amid an economy that finds most Americans still struggling to make ends meet. These are the same institutions that were the largest recipients of taxpayer bailout money, and, not coincidentally, the same institutions that engaged in the risky practices that brought the world economy to the brink of collapse. In part one of a two-part interview, Mark Gilbert, London Bureau Chief of Bloomberg News and author of Complicit, How Greed and Collusion Made the Credit Crisis Unstoppable, says there are a number of factors that went into making the financial crisis, and among them was the gradual deregulation of Wall Street.
You had a fantastic economic backdrop. You had almost perfect financial conditions. You had China for the first time flooding the West with cheap goods and keeping inflation low. That in turn meant that central banks could keep the cost of money extremely low. You had financial firms that had successfully lobbied for what few rules and regulations there were to be dismantled. You had technology connecting the world together in financial terms in ways it had never seen before. So you had almost instantaneous flow of information. And so you had all the recipe there for an incredible explosion in things like the derivatives market, which depended massively on technology to get going. You had an explosion in leverage, where you were able to take $1 and borrow 19 against it in an era of cheap money because central banks were keeping interest rates low. So we had a potent mixture of conditions that led to a credit boom. And if you tie that to what happened in the U.S. mortgage market, where, you know, U.S. home ownership had been about 64% for several years, and then it suddenly ticked up to about 70%. Those last 5 or 6% of people taking mortgages, most of whom were subprime borrowers, most of whom wouldn't have been able to borrow in previous economic environments, that provided the kindling for a financial bonfire, which is what caused the credit crisis.
To some extent, as you said, China came into the scene with very low-priced goods, and they suddenly had $1 trillion of money to spend in the markets. But also, the financial firms were creating money out of thin air. How did they do this?
Well, I'll give you an example. The example I use in the book is car insurance. If you own a car, you typically buy insurance, which is a way of protecting yourself from an accident, so that if you have a crash, you can get money from the insurance company. You pay a premium for that, right? And then that will be sort of your safeguard in the event of something bad happening. What the financial companies were able to do in the derivatives market was write insurance on cars that didn't exist for people who didn't even have a driving license. And then you could buy and sell that insurance. So you were creating risk out of thin air. You were creating premiums on assets that didn't exist. And you were buying and selling securities that had no real tether to the real world. There was no skin in the game. In this way, leverage was created, risk was created, and so one of the things that the regulators missed during the credit boom was they thought that credit was being sliced and diced and moved to its most appropriate places. They thought that risk was flowing to those who had an appetite for it, away from those who maybe couldn't manage it so well. Instead, what it turned out was happening was car insurance on cars that didn't exist, creating a risk that didn't exist before, and giving people a way of betting on markets that they'd never been allowed to bet on before, and using basically money that was borrowed to make those bets. And so that's how money was created out of thin air. That's how we ended up with this system of virtual risks that we'd never seen before in the markets.
Now, how were they able to get away with creating money, selling insurance on cars that didn't exist, as you say? Isn't the financial world supposed to be anchored to reality someplace? Where's the regulation that failed?
The regulation failed again because it was supposed to be slicing and dicing risk, and there were supposed to be mathematical models that were telling you how the future was going to turn out. Unfortunately, those models all turned out to be based on one very simple bet of induction, which was that the future would always turn out to be like the past. And so the regulations were inadequate to cope with this new globalized finance industry in an era of extremely cheap money, when you had your basic investor trying to chase higher returns than they could get in normal markets because low inflation was keeping returns low in turn, and so you weren't getting much on deposit, you weren't getting much in the bond market, stock market growth, while it was steady, was not going to be spectacular. And so you had all these elements that played in that allowed the finance industry to create a global casino that had much, much higher odds than anything we'd seen before, much more money available to it to make those gambles. And then there were certain key elements along the way. For instance, the abolition of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was a regulation that basically meant if you were a bank that took deposits from people, if you held nest eggs and savings from average people, you weren't allowed to have an investment bank and take on that kind of risky business. That act, after much lobbying by the banks, was dismantled under the Clinton administration. And so that gave the finance industry a lot more freedom to engage in this kind of risk-seeking behavior where they were seeking higher returns, they were able to use those deposits to make those bets, and unfortunately it all turned out bad in the end.
Was this simply a matter of greed? Was this competition to come up with the most creative way to best the next financial institution and come up with a supposedly more profitable derivative? What drove this?
Greed's definitely in there. It's part of the DNA of finance to try and be creative, to try and find a way around existing rules and regulations, to always be pushing the envelope, always seeking that next transaction, that next complex deal. The way the bonus system was structured was really a big problem in this. It transpired that you were able to make these private bets and make bonuses, and then if the bets went wrong, they became public liabilities, which is kind of where we are now and kind of what the politicians are wrestling with. The bonus system structure definitely incentivized people to seek bigger and bigger risks, to try and outdo the firm next door, to try and earn more money than they did so that you'd get paid more. But there were no speed bumps built into the system. You didn't have any skin in the game as an investment banker. Your pay was largely in cash. You may have got some of your pay in the form of shares, but it was a much smaller proportion than it should have been. You weren't locked in for very long, and you certainly didn't have to repay the money if it turned out that 3, 4, 5 years down the line, those bets you'd been paid for turned out to be not so clever bets in the first place, and in fact ended up costing the firm money. So greed was definitely a dominant factor in the behavior of individuals who contributed to this crisis.
Have they learned anything? Is this bonus structure still paying dividends for bad investments or bad planning?
Well, President Obama has come out and said, you know what, enough is enough. He says he's going to fight the finance firms. He's going to limit how big they're allowed to be. He's going to limit what kinds of activities banks can undertake. And there's definitely the impression that the banks so far have failed to apologize for what happened. There's no contriteness, there's no recognition that they've been bailed out with taxpayers' money. And guess what? The government's angry now. I think that your president is going to severely slap on the shackles and start to build in the kinds of safeguards that are needed so that it doesn't really matter whether the bankers recognize what they did wrong and recognize that that behavior, that kind of risk-taking activity went too far. I think that the regulators are finally going to be in a position to do it for them and to simply not allow those kind of risks to be taken in the future. I think we're at a key turning point. You know, it would have been a shame if this crisis was wasted. And I'm much more optimistic after seeing that the authorities are going to finally grasp the nettle and make sure that the finance industry acts in check, acts to bolster the real economy, and doesn't get away with that kind of behavior in the future.
Mark Gilbert is London Bureau Chief of Bloomberg News and author of Complicit: How Greed and Collusion Made the Credit Crisis Unstoppable. Last week marked the anniversary of President Obama's promise to close the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in 1 year. But almost 200 prisoners are still there. Some were cleared for release years ago, but the administration says it cannot return them to their home countries for fear of mistreatment, and finding other countries to take them remains difficult. A few were scheduled for trial in U.S. criminal courts. Some will still face the long-discredited military tribunals. And late last week, the Obama administration announced that about 50 will continue to be held indefinitely without charges or trial in any court. Meanwhile, several members of Congress, upset by the fact that the Nigerian man accused of the failed Christmas Day bombing of a Detroit-bound airliner will be handled by a federal criminal court, have introduced legislation that would require intelligence officials to be consulted about how to handle terrorism suspects after their capture, arguing that options other than the criminal justice system should be considered. Christopher Anders, senior legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, says the bill was introduced after a Senate hearing last week when Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut questioned intelligence agencies about how the arrest of the Christmas Day bomber had been handled.
And when some of these intelligence officials said that they had not been asked specifically whether the Christmas Day bomber should be charged in federal court and interrogated by the FBI, then Senator Collins and Senator Lieberman took the next step of introducing this bill. And so what this bill does is it basically says that whenever the Justice Department takes into its custody a terrorism suspect, that they can't interrogate that person or charge that person with a crime until they basically get sign off from the heads of all the different intelligence agencies. And if they don't all agree, then they would then have to go to the president to try to get the president to okay the Justice Department doing the interrogation and charging the suspect with a crime, which seems to be a tremendous amount of interference with the way terrorism cases have always gone forward, and a way to try to deprive people of their basic rights under the Constitution, since this would apply even within the United States.
There are a couple of things about this that are troublesome. For one thing, it would place a huge amount of discretion in the hands of the executive branch, from the definition of terrorism to the detention of individuals based on policy rather than statements of law.
Exactly. And what it does is it ends up politicizing the criminal justice system. That rather than having an independent Department of Justice, a attorney general who's looking out to enforce the law only, ultimately it would be the president making a decision on what happens with various criminal suspects. And that goes against the tradition, the long tradition the United States has had of letting criminal justice decisions, prosecutorial decisions, be made by prosecutors and not by the president. So we don't have the president making the decisions in the Oval Office of this person will be prosecuted, this person won't be prosecuted. Those are the kinds of decisions that the Attorney General should be making and the Justice Department should be making, and not the president and certainly not the intelligence officials.
On Friday, the White House announced, or at least the Obama administration announced, that it had taken that authority, at least in terms of 47 of the detainees at Guantanamo, saying that they will be held without charges indefinitely. Is this decision related to this legislation at all? Certainly this has been in the works for a long time. It's been discussed for a long time. Where does this fit into the whole picture?
Well, this bill's not related, but this bill from Senator Collins and Senator Lieberman would make us even more worried about this claim by the president that he has the authority to detain people without ever charging them or trying them in a court, because it means that the president would ultimately have the decision of whether someone's going to be charged or tried in a federal criminal court. And then certainly it leaves open the possibility of the next step of the president making a decision this person could simply be held forever without being charged.
Were the senators behind this legislation able to point to any deficiencies in the criminal justice process that has been pursued with terrorism suspects so far? It seems that they've been much more successful than any alternatives that this administration or the prior administration came up with.
The part that is amazing is that through our criminal justice system, there have been over 200 defendants who are now serving time, serious time, in the federal criminal prison system for international terrorism crimes. By contrast, there are exactly three people who have been convicted of crimes in the military commission system. So the tried and true system of putting people in federal criminal court, having the Justice Department prosecute them, has resulted in over 200 convictions. The system that people like Senator Lieberman have been pushing, the military commission system, has resulted in three prosecutions. Two of those people have now been released. So there's actually only one person sitting at Guantanamo who's actually ever been convicted of a crime.
How many of those were actually plea bargains?
I think only one actually went to verdict.
So where does this legislation stand at this point?
Well, I mean, this is at the very, very beginning stage. And I think one of the things that we wanted to do is make sure people were aware that this was the road that some senators want to head down. But the bill was just introduced at the end of last week. It was sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where fortunately the chairman, Senator Leahy, is someone who is a strong proponent of using our federal court system and giving prosecutors the tools that they need to bring cases in federal criminal court, but not making up new rules as we go along. So it has been sent to his committee. But the problem in the Senate, of course, is that just like they often can't get anything done with some legislation, other legislation, all kinds of completely unrelated amendments can get attached. And so this is something that I think all of us have to be watching very carefully, that it doesn't end up being slapped onto a totally unrelated bill as the year goes by.
Christopher Anders is a senior legislative counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, January 26, 2010. The news was produced in New York with Rebecca Miles. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 26, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, in Haiti, doctors raise concern over long-term treatment for the injured.
We have inadequate support for the long-term needs of a population that is this wounded and this traumatized.
President Obama announces a 3-year spending freeze ahead of his State of the Union address. And a new report finds that male students of color face high dropout rates and lower numbers of degrees in higher education. Experts say it's a national crisis. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two Venezuelan students were killed during demonstrations against a government-ordered shutdown of the country's oldest television station yesterday. The two, including a 15-year-old, were shot in the city of Mérida. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets during clashes between groups both supporting and opposing the government in a number of Venezuelan cities. Over the weekend, the popular opposition television station RCTV, along with five other stations, was ordered off the air after refusing to broadcast a speech by President Hugo Chavez. Protests were expected to continue today. As attacks in Afghanistan continue, the International Committee of the Red Cross says more must be done to protect civilians. Asma Namadi reports from Kabul.
An explosion outside a U.S. base in the Afghan capital today wounded 14 people, including 8 civilians. Just over a week ago, attacks in the heart of Kabul killed 12 people, adding to the rising number of civilian casualties. Today, the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, called on all parties, the Afghan National Security Forces, the International Military Forces, and the armed opposition, to minimize civilian deaths and injuries. ICRC spokesperson Carla Haddad-Mardini expands that call from combat zones to areas far away from the battlefields.
What we're seeing on the ground is that medical facilities and first aid posts are not spared the effect of the fighting. They're even sometimes directly targeted. Ambulances are sometimes blocked, so people cannot be easily evacuated. And medical workers who venture in these areas do it at the risk of their lives.
As President Karzai prepares for an international conference on Afghanistan later this week in London, major figures within the U.S. military have hinted at a deal with the Taliban. The U.N. recently took off names of 6 terrorists from its blacklist to ease communicating with them about the deal. Asma Namadi, FSRN, Kabul.
Before the polls even closed in Sri Lanka's first peacetime vote in more than 25 years, senior political leaders moved to block the projected winner from taking office. They say that General Sarath Fonseca, who led the military's defeat of the Tamil Tigers, is not eligible to serve because he's not registered to vote. Incumbent President Mahinda Rajapaksa is hoping for renewed support for his administration, but the opposition accuses Rajapaksa of abuse of power, corruption, and nepotism. With the majority vote closely divided between the two candidates, the Tamil vote is viewed as central to the final outcome. The death toll in northern Nigeria's sectarian violence continues to climb, and officials have made mass arrests. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The police put the latest death toll at 326, but the final figure may be substantially higher, as Muslim officials say 364 Muslims were killed. Christian groups are also claiming a large death toll. People who fled nearby villages, which were also affected by the crisis, now are returning home to find scores of corpses. Nigeria's Emergency Management Agency says it is helping displaced victims of the conflict. Some 40,000 people, including children orphaned by the crisis, are in 18 camps. Christian groups allege that Muslim members of the police force and the army actually took part in killing Christians during the crisis. Officials say 313 people have been arrested. The sectarian crisis is the latest in a series of religious conflicts between Christians and Muslims to hit Nigeria in the last 12 years. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
A Chinese court sentenced four more people to death for what they call violent crimes of attacking, smashing, looting, and burning during sectarian violence in Urumqi last year. Nine others have already been executed, and the four newly sentenced join 22 others awaiting execution over the unrest. The names of the convicted indicate that they are Uyghurs. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has suggested a new way of resolving the issue of overcrowding in the state's prison system by sending the prisoners to facilities in Mexico. Shannon Young has more.
Governor Schwarzenegger estimates California could save $1 billion by housing an estimated 20,000 undocumented prisoners in jails built south of the border. Schwarzenegger's comments came during a question and answer session at the Sacramento Press Club. He suggested that the state could pay for the construction of prison infrastructure and guards in Mexico at half the cost of a California facility. California is running a budget deficit of nearly $20 billion. A spokesperson for the governor's office later clarified that the idea is not an official proposal. However, the legal conditions for such a deal are feasible since Mexico reformed its criminal justice code last year to open the door to private investment in the prison system. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
Guatemalan officials caught up with former President Alfonso Portillo. They arrested him during a raid on a ranch this morning. Portillo was indicted by the U.S. courts yesterday on charges of money laundering. The indictment charges that the former president funneled $1.5 million through U.S. banks. The funds were intended to buy books for Guatemalan school libraries. Portillo faces charges in Guatemala as well. The United States has frozen funds on a five-year plan to finance education initiatives in Kenya. The U.S. ambassador in Nairobi said today that steps must be taken to find out just what happened to $1.4 million that's missing from the East African nation's public education fund. The U.K. ended its financial support of the program last month when an audit revealed the missing money. Free education in Kenya began in 2003, allowing more than 1 million poor children access to an education in the first year alone. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Doreen Marina in New York. Haiti's President René Préval is urgently calling for an additional 200,000 tents for the country's homeless and asked for planes carrying tents to have priority at Port-au-Prince's airport. Attention is focusing on the country's nearly 1 million left without shelter by the earthquake. The UN has cleared 12 acres north of Port-au-Prince, which it hopes will be used as sites for temporary settlements. An estimated 200,000 have already fled the capital. Dr. Joya Mukherjee is the medical director for Partners in Health, an organization that has 170 medical teams in Haiti. She calls this a massive demographic shift in Haiti that is putting pressure on rural communities.
Mayors and local officials have asked us for thousands and thousands of tents as they try to absorb and, house the numbers of refugees that are flooding out of the capital who have lost their homes.
Dr. Mukherjee said her teams are concerned about infections. Staff has already found cases of tetanus, and in a country where vaccinations are uncommon, the danger is widespread. Another long-term concern is aiding recovery for the thousands of survivors who underwent amputations as a result of crushing injuries. Dr. Mukherjee said the country lacks support for these survivors.
We're going to need a lot of rehab support, a lot of prosthetic support, but also some vision of what it is going to be like to have a nation of people, many of whom are disabled. And then add to that, which, I think goes hand in hand, there is a huge amount of psychological trauma. And one, for people with amputations, and then two, just psychological trauma in general. And we have inadequate kind of support for the long-term needs of a population that is this wounded and this traumatized.
The United Nations has also identified care after surgery as a priority. Paul Garwood is a spokesperson for the World Health Organization.
In particular, we see a great need for services for amputees. There have been thousands of people who have suffered amputations as a result of this emergency. We're seeing in some hospitals every day from 30 to 100 amputations taking place. At the moment, the key focus for WHO and other health providers on the ground is to provide better and more rehabilitation and other post-op services to enable people to recover from their amputations.
Meanwhile, in Port-au-Prince, roads are beginning to open up, but there are still reports of aid delayed at the airport as people wait in long lines for food and water on the streets of the capital. FSRN reporter Dolores M. Bernal is in Port-au-Prince. Dolores, where are we reaching you right now?
Right, I find myself in the middle of Port-au-Prince. It's a very hot day today, but, you know, people are starting to make their way around town. A lot of the streets seem to be open. However, there are many that are still closed, and so it can be hard to get from point A to point B to whatever you're trying to go.
And a lot of attention is focused, of course, on the airport where much of the aid and support personnel is coming through. You arrived there yesterday. What did you see at the airport when you came in?
What I saw from outside my window landing onto Port-au-Prince was a sea of campsites being set out by the U.S. military that have come to aid the country. There's definitely a huge presence of also U.N. Personnel, and it's pretty amazing to see, you know, how much aid has actually made it into Haiti, and also amazing to see that the aid is still at the airport. There are tons and tons of pallets full of food that are just sitting there. And even though this has been brought to the attention of the U.S. military, you know, it seems like little has been done to try to get that aid to be moving faster. There's still a lot of people lining up outside of the airport to ask for food and water. But they are always being turned away, told that they're being told to go to certain distribution centers around town. But even that's a little realistic just because, you know, the transportation system here, it's pretty remote. And so to tell people go to this or that address, it's pretty amazing.
Well, what are the conditions of the roads in the city? Are cars and vehicles driving around? Is there transportation available?
It seems like the main roads have been cleared. There's traffic moving from different parts of town, but mostly the main roads. We drove through some neighborhoods where the roads were blocked by debris. A lot of homes have banners that say things like, help me, help us, SOS. People have taken spray and sprayed up the walls of their homes and businesses saying, you know, we need help.
And how about food and water? Have you seen that being distributed anywhere? Have you seen people buying and selling it on the street? Or what's the status of people's access to those basic needs?
That's perhaps the most sad part of this whole catastrophe, the fact that a lot of people are lining up whatever they can to look for water. There are mobile trucks that are actually tanks are moving around the city that are stopping at certain places. There's also a lot of people who find themselves really isolated. We stopped at a camp, I guess they call them tent cities. We stopped at a tent city where people were just standing around, you know, waiting for anybody who will pass by and give them food and water. It was a campsite that was located in an area that is called Del Mar, and it was being run by a Catholic pediatrician who told me that there were about 800 people in that tent city, and there were only 80 tents.
So 800 people, only 80 tents. I imagine those people are just out on the street.
Right. And the heartbreaking part is that she told me that of the 800 people, 200 of them were children. And these are kids who, you know, a lot of them have lost their parents. I spoke with a woman who was carrying a little baby girl who had a bandage around her head, and I asked her if she was the mother, and she told me that she was the grandmother, that the mother had died, and that she was now taking care of the little girl, but that she didn't have a place to go. And so she was staying in one of those tents.
I see. Dolores, thank you very much. The ongoing recovery and the need still very great. We look forward to more of your reporting later this week. Thank you and take care.
Thank you very much.
Dolores M. Bernal is an FSRN reporter. We reached her by mobile phone in Port-au-Prince. With the spread of online media, finding out what happened today is only a click away. But finding media that can provide understanding and perspective about the news is far more rare. Since 2000, Free Speech Radio News has aired on-the-ground reports from all over the U.S. and the world, and we have connected the dots to show the global connections in the news. Whether we're explaining policy maneuvering in Washington or army maneuvering in Pakistan, FSRN makes the connections that help you be a citizen of the world. Your support of FSRN goes a long way to help keep this in-depth news coverage coming. Visit FSRN.org to find out how you can help. I'm Doran Marina, and you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Stay with us. And in Washington, President Obama has announced a 3-year freeze on discretionary spending. The news comes just ahead of his second State of the Union address scheduled for Wednesday evening and is part of his administration's focus on the economy. The announcement is being met by frustration among liberal lawmakers. Conservatives say the president is moving in the right direction. FSRN's Leon Caldwell reports.
In his State of the Union, President Obama is expected to highlight a freeze on non-military discretionary spending. Even flat budgets usually see increases for inflation. This proposal would not. This announcement comes just as the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that the budget outlook looks bleak. The government could rack up $6 trillion of debt over 10 years. The president's spending freeze would cut just a fraction of that, about $0.25 trillion in that same time. As realities of unemployment and a weak economy weigh heavily on Washington, liberal lawmakers question Obama's move. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says the president is focusing on the wrong part of the budget.
There are some agencies of government, including the Defense Department, where we can actually cut spending.
Programs that will not see budget cuts: military, homeland security, veterans affairs, and mandatory spending. That includes Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. According to the National Priorities Project, defense spending consists of at least 20% of the national budget. It's the second largest piece of the pie behind Social Security. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio says it's hypocritical to cut programs after increasing the deficit with war spending and tax cuts on the wealthy.
Our response to that is cut spending on infrastructure or cut spending on human needs doesn't fly with me.
Non-military discretionary spending consumes about 1/7 of the national budget. Programs that could be affected are commerce, energy, education, interior, NASA, and more. The administration says the cuts would not be across the board. Instead, some programs would see spending increases. Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Rob Neighbors, said the president's priorities did not receive cuts. He said specifics will be released Monday when the budget comes out. While liberals are uneasy at first glance, conservative Democrats and Republicans applaud the president's proposal. Senator John McCain referred to a line often used during the presidential campaign.
Look, I think that the president understands now how serious this problem is, and it requires hatchets and scalpels. It requires a hatchet to bring it under control, and it requires the scalpel to eliminate the wasteful and unnecessary spending that characterizes so much of this bloated spending process we're in.
Robert Greenstein is director of the liberal-leaning Center on Budget Policy Priorities. Greenstein says this proposal is both symbol and substance.
It seems to me that this is a savvy move. I believe that it will be harder for the president and those who want to see further jobs legislation to get it passed unless it's not accompanied with some sort of a signal of some initial move, even if modest, on the longer-term deficit front.
Senate Democrats have begun discussions about a jobs package, which is estimated to cost around $80 billion. The spending freeze is proposed to begin after that, in 2011. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Across the U.S., young male students of color face higher dropout rates and lower rates of attending and graduating from college. While the statistics aren't surprising, the Higher Education Admissions Group, the College Board, wants to increase the visibility of the problem. On Capitol Hill today, the group joined lawmakers and experts to discuss what can be done to address this challenge. FSRN's Karen Miller reports.
Education experts say there's a long list of obstacles keeping men of color from graduating from high school and advancing to college. Poverty, language barriers, high rates of incarceration, and a lack of role models and qualified teachers are just a few. Ronald Williams is a vice president of the College Board. He says while all children face these issues in communities of color, boys are the hardest hit.
Okay, the whole community is having a problem, but half of the community is male, right? So in some ways, the problem could be the male problem, even though you're thinking of it as the larger community problem. So it seems to me knowing which parts of your community is suffering the most, if you can tackle those areas, you also help the overall community because it's such a large part of the community.
The College Board released the new report in an effort to galvanize reform efforts across the country. The group calls the education disparity a national crisis. Tom Rudin is vice president for advocacy and government relations with the College Board.
It's a moral and economic imperative that this country has to adopt as a priority. I mean, we have tens of thousands of students of color who are not able to contribute to our economic development, and we're importing people from overseas to meet the jobs that we have in science and technology. Why not invest in the youth that we have here in this country, make a commitment to their economic well-being? We all benefit from that.
According to the report, the high school graduation rate for black males is around 70%. For Latino males, it's around 60%. That compares to about 84% for white males. The rate of minority males who have some type of college degree is around 20% for black males and 13% for Latino males. That's compared to 36% for white males. In addition, men of color have a higher number of school suspensions than white males and females of their own ethnic group. Some educators say a lack of male role models contributes to minority males starting on the road to educational underachievement. Roy Jones is the executive director of Call Me Mister, a black male teacher development program.
It's important to have in the classroom someone that reflects your background, your experience, communicates with you in a way that you understand, and really creates a kind of a confidence that you can be successful. So having a difference in an image is very critical.
The report looked at African American, Latino, Asian American Pacific Islanders, and Native American males. Robert Teranishi is Associate Professor of Higher Education at New York University. He said Asian males are often overlooked when examining education underachievement.
And they occupy the full range of the socioeconomic spectrum, from the poor and underprivileged to the affluent and highly skilled. So if there's any conclusion that can be drawn about the population, it's that they're an incredibly heterogeneous group, and there's simply no single narrative that can capture the range of educational experiences, opportunities, and outcomes they encounter.
In addition to the College Board, civil rights groups, educators, and lawmakers attended Tuesday's event. They're calling for the educational achievement of young men of color to be a top U.S. policy priority. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Public interest advocates are applauding a decision by the Federal Transit Authority to withhold $70 million in stimulus funding from the Bay Area Rapid Transit Agency for possible violations of the Civil Rights Act. The issue surrounds a $500 million BART transportation project called the Oakland Airport Connector. Critics say the project is geared toward more affluent people and leaves out low-income residents and people of color. Bob Allen is Transportation and Housing Director with Urban Habitat, one of the Bay Area advocacy groups that helped to file a Title VI complaint against BART.
Of particular concern for us is the prohibitive costs for riding the new project. The connector would replace an existing bus shuttle that presently delivers passengers and workers to the airport in as little as 12 minutes at a fare of $3 each way. However, under the new connector, passengers and workers would be charged $6 each way, or $12 round trip, on top of their normal BART fare. And the price alone would exclude many Oakland residents, and we believe will impose a significant economic burden on airport workers, many of whom are low-wage earners.
Allen says they're also concerned that the project doesn't include stops along the way, thus limiting the number of people who would use the project for transportation. Reverend Scott Denman with the advocacy group Genesis says the faith community sees the issue as Robin Hood in reverse.
When you take money out of stimulus funds and use it to assist those who can afford airline tickets while taking away opportunities for those to ride buses to schools, to church, to work, to the doctor, the injustice is not only obvious, but quite obscene, in our opinion, and it's really a no-brainer.
Some watching this case say the federal government's actions in Oakland are significant, as it indicates a commitment to investigate civil rights complaints. Former senior policy advisor for the Department of Transportation, Mark Brandman, said this is the first time stimulus funds have been withheld for social equity purposes.
Since 1964, the principle of the Civil Rights Act has been that federal money should not be spent in a discriminatory way. President Clinton's Environmental Justice Executive Order in 1995 required federal agencies to examine and reduce the adverse impacts of federal projects on low-income and minority people. USDOT and FTA wrote guidance for Title VI in the executive order years ago. Now they've shown how to make that guidance work with the help of dedicated public advocates.
The FTA gave BART a March 5th deadline to meet several demands, including conducting an adequate equity analysis that examines the project's impact on transportation service and fares. If BART fails to meet the deadline, the stimulus funds could be reallocated to another entity or project. In a statement, BART said they have, quote, always been and will continue to be committed to providing non-discriminatory, equitable, accessible, and safe public transportation to all the Bay Area residents. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.
Check this out. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
This is Laverne McDonald, chair of the WBAI Pacifica Radio Community Advisory Board, inviting you to a meeting of the board on Tuesday, January 26th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., at the 6th Street Community Center, 638 East 6th Street, between Avenues B and C. That's Tuesday, January 26th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the 6th Street Community Center, 638 East 6th Street, between Avenues B and C. For more information, contact 212-209-2800.
Chinese music actually has quite a rich history, and as actually our Western music is the result of a lot of Sudanese rhythms, patterns, and melodies. First reggae rhythm ever recorded in the world was actually out of Sudan. Most people think that it was out of Jamaica, but they really actually, there was the first influences came from Sudan. The basis of some of our rhythm and blues music is actually based out of their rhythms and their sound, which the rest of the world inherited as they started naming genres of music. But little did they know that some of the foundations of their rhythms, as they call it, rock, jazz, blues, actually started in parts of Sudan.
Marhaba, this is Barbara Nimri-Aziz. By way of introducing today's program, you've heard the remarkable, dedicated music producer, Don Elder. Today, we focus on Sudan, with the studio visit at WBAI of a group of Sudanese creative artists, all musicians. We invite you to stay with us for this special edition of Tahrir. Now, here's a word of introduction from Dr. Mutawakkil Muhammad, who has this to say about that visit.
What we are trying to do, to show the whole world that this country, Sudan, is a beautiful country, that the people of Sudan are beautiful people and determined to live together and determined to solve their problems. And who's better than artists, singers, to do that? We know that political leaders, more often than not, they fail to unify a country. These singers, as I said, I can see it in their eyes, that they are more determined than ever to unify and to unite this country, and the whole world will know and see what is Sudan and who are the Sudanese.
في ظني منك ولا منك يا المسير في ظني منك
Years ago, at the Summer Festival in New York City, local audiences were introduced to the music of the Sudan by a large group of talented musicians, vocalists, and instrumentalists. For many, it was perhaps their introduction to the music of the largest nation in Africa, a nation of diversity and wealth, intellectual as well as mineral. Most of us only think of Sudan today in the context of war, with the people of Darfur singled out. In fact, the coming together of these musicians was itself a call for Sudan's national unity. We were delighted that many in the Sudan troupe came into our WBAI studios to play, sing, laugh, and talk. Today's Tahrir is a full-hour program from that wonderful gathering. We're grateful to the festival producer, Don Elder, and the program sponsor, Dr. Mutawakkil Mahmoud. They were with us in the studio, as well as with Dr. Mutawakkil Mahmoud assisting with translation. Our studio engineer was WBAI's Kamu Kalfani. The musicians we will hear are Hadia Talsam and Amal Talsam, Omar Al-Sas, Emmanuel Kembe, Yusuf El-Musri, and Ali Sigaid. Now let's join them as they talk about their work and perform for us.
Umadakamidad, the range between me and you like an ink. So that will make the space between me and you close, like flower, perfume, like love, something like that. In the night, especially, yeah.
Madaka midat means the relation between them, it is so extended. And the definition of ink here doesn't mean that's exactly it's ink. It's just how important to have continuation and build the relation between two parts at any single moment at night. And that's a meaning, yes.
It's a modern song.
Actually, that song is written, his name is Assam Abubakar Adam, and I made the melody for it, the music composition. I made it for it, for myself, and then another singer came and just kidnapped this song. This Ali. And then we used to sing it together. It's new, it's modern. It's a contemporary song. The orchestra contains strings and brass section and bass and guitars and all the rhythm section and everything.
This is a song for everything.
Forever.
We used to sing it. I like to listen to this song on the oud because it's just like it gives me the feelings better. You know, I feel it better with oud. I prefer it rather than the orchestra.
Ma bassa rhythm, Zay?
Yeah.